and this is Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. Listing all the issues and questions that occupied the mind of Walter Benjamin would take all day, or perhaps many days and nights. Benjamin, the brilliant German-Jewish critic and philosopher, is best known for his writings during the interwar period, writings filled with original, sometimes startling assertions about art, technology, politics, and language. But, as a new book reveals, there is much more to Benjamin than the things he wrote during the 1920s and 30s. As early as age 18, Benjamin was thinking about and writing incisively on such topics as the education and awakening of youth, the relationship between history, memory, and the present, and the fostering of the creative spirit and the search for truth. The volume Early Writings, 1910 to 1917, is edited by Howard Island and published by Harvard University Press. Island teaches literature at MIT and has edited and translated a number of works by Walter Benjamin. He's currently collaborating on a biography of the man. When Howard Island joined me recently by phone, I asked if he would attempt a brief assessment of Benjamin's importance as a thinker.
He is particularly hard to categorize, I would say. You can't pigeonhole Walter Benjamin. You know, his influence has been very widespread, especially after the 60s, the 1960s. And the influence has to do with what he calls reception in distraction. He takes the film medium as a kind of model or training ground, he calls it, for a new set of habits of listening and of perceiving. And the way in which we watch a film, he says, is in some sense exemplary for the way in which we experience modern life, especially modern metropolitan life. So, early viewers of the cinema were sort of befuddled by the fact that no sooner had they seen an image than another image appeared. They couldn't focus on it. They couldn't contemplate the images of film in the way that they could contemplate the images of painting. And so there was this sort of frustration among some early intellectual viewers with the medium. And Benjamin argues that this distraction is actually essential to the film medium itself, and that we learn to perceive the content of the film through this quick changing, and that this is not so different from what happens when we cross a street in a big city and are dodging traffic and looking at traffic lights and reading signs and carrying on a conversation and looking at our watches and doing, you know, all these things simultaneously. Or if you work in the stock market and the kinds of reception and distraction that goes on there, or listening to jazz music in particular, or even playing jazz music and following the work of your fellow musicians while you're improvising your own line. There are many examples of this kind of reception in a state of distraction that Benjamin sees as exemplary for modern life. And so that kind of new way of seeing and experiencing, which he thinks is modeled in the film medium in particular, is, I think, one of his central contributions to, you know, thinking about the new media and experience, as I say, in the modern world in general. But his influence goes in many, many different directions. That's just a beginning.
Yeah, it's a very difficult task I've given you. Well, certainly, the ideas we'll discuss this hour, we'll see to what extent they relate to some of the epiphanies or insights he developed later in his life. Before we talk about his work beginning 1910, which is when he was 18 years old, his early life, before he became a teenager, what can you tell us about his upbringing?
He was raised in a wealthy, upper-middle-class Jewish family in Berlin. His father was a businessman who had a partnership in an auctioneering business, actually was an auctioneer himself, and a connoisseur of rugs, of wine, of various other forms of furnishing and of artworks. And Benjamin grew up in a household that was full of French maids and servants of various kinds. He had private tutors until the age of 9 and rather delicate health, so that when he finally did go to the public school in his neighborhood in Berlin, in Charlottenburg, he had to leave after a couple of years, and his parents sent him to a private boarding school in the country named Haubinda, where he stayed for 2 years, and where he met a man who was a very important influence on his early thinking, Gustav Weinecken, who was an educational reformer and who taught a class in German literature, which Benjamin took, and where he was introduced to philosophy. So that literature and philosophy came to him together and always remained together in his work.
And Weinecken was founder of something called the Free School Community,
right.
And he seemed very interested in the issue in the event of kind of a youth awakening. What did he believe was necessary to bring about such an awakening?
The awakening would take its form, he thought, from or in the form of a cultural awakening. Youth was for him not a transition to adulthood. It was not something that you go through in order to prepare yourself for the realities of adult life. It was rather a state valuable in itself, a state devoted to experience and study. And so the school that he that you referred to, the free school community, was devoted to interdisciplinary studies, including science, music, history, literature, mathematics, and so on, and also physical work, physical exercise, dance. And the idea was to create a kind of universal culture that would be both intellectual and physical. And this would, in some sense, make a kind of a threshold for how to live throughout the rest of your life, and so that the spirit of youth would remain with you as you grew older. And this cultural awakening was essentially what Weinecken meant by youth. And so Benjamin takes this idea of awakening, which has a long history of messianic thinking behind it, and develops it in various ways, and it stays with him throughout his career. In his later work, beginning in the late 1920s, especially under the influence of surrealism, he comes to think of the past as a great dream, a dream that haunts us and that we carry around with us. And in order to waken from the past, and especially from the recent past, from the world of our parents and grandparents, in order to awaken from that past, we have to descend back into it, down to its most obscure and tiniest little corner.
And how do we do that? How do we descend into history or certain aspects of it?
By looking at the documents of the everyday life of the past. So that Benjamin's work, especially in his sort of magnum opus, The Arcades Project, which he began working on in 1927 and continued through the end of his life and did not complete. In The Arcades Project, he's looking at advertisements from the mid-19th century. He's looking at posters that were up for a day or two in the streets of Paris, looking at clothing styles, at letters, and so on. Documents from the everyday life of the population, not so much at the great men and the great events that historiographers traditionally study. And by getting a sense of the daily life, one can actually enter into, and as I say, sort of descend back into this dream past, and thus awaken from it, so that one awakens from the past only by awakening to it. It's a dialectic, he says. The awakening, he talks about the dialectic of awakening.
Benjamin was heavily involved in the years before World War I in what's called the German Youth Movement, and I read in the introduction to this new volume, Early Writings, 1910 to 1917, by Walter Benjamin, his expression, a new humanity, or producing a new humanity. To what extent was the production of that by youth, to what extent does that relate to what you're saying he thought and wrote about later
he stayed with that idea again throughout his career, the idea of a new humanity. And of course, he wasn't the only one to talk in those terms. It was a very common way of talking in the first few decades of the 20th century, both on the left and on the right. The idea of a new humanity is something you hear in proto-fascist, proto-Nazi thinking as well. In Benjamin's case, it had to do again with this idea of a new way of seeing and experiencing. This, in turn, presupposed a new sensorium, so that it was a kind of bodily, spiritual approach to life, or entry into life. And here, the influence of Nietzsche is really important. Weineken, whom we were just talking about, his teacher at Halbinda, and who remained his mentor throughout those early years up until World War I, Weineken was essentially a kind of popularizing Nietzschean. And he emphasized the Nietzschean tragic quality of life, at the same time that there was this notion of a kind of breakthrough into a new consciousness and a new bodily consciousness. It has to do with breaking out of a certain kind of traditional and dogmatic way of thinking. And I relate it to the influence also of Henri Bergson, whom he read in his first years at the university, 1912, 13, 14. Bergson talks about the logic of solids. He says that our concepts and our habits of daily thinking are formed on the model of solids, and that what's at stake in this new awakening is the dissolution of the logic of solids and a sense of a new dynamic, vibratory universe that is, in fact, I think, in keeping with modern physics, ideas of physics, to the dissolution of the solid atom and the sense that everything is in motion all the time. The sense of the vibratory and the dynamic is always in the background of Benjamin's ideas of a new awakening, a new humanity.
Howard Eiland teaches literature at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he is editor of a new volume of the German thinker Walter Benjamin's early writings, 1910 to 1917. Benjamin was a German-Jewish literary critic, philosopher, sociologist, and essayist who lived from 1892 to 1940. Most people think of school and of family life as the two venues for learning, for instruction. What did Benjamin think of this?
Those were his bête noire. The youth movement that you referred to, especially in its Weineckian guise, was directly opposed to the traditions of the school and the family. And what Benjamin envisioned was what he called a learning community. This new awakening had to do with a sense of a community of learning that would have broken from the logic of solids that we were just talking about, and from all dogmatism, from all churches, and would continually be engaged in making a space for questioning and for keeping in mind what he thought of as the spiritual crisis of modernity, a crisis that was, in effect, concealed in the material security of modern life. This sense of crisis, which again has a kind of Nietzschean antecedent, has to do with the idea that life in its essence is groundless, is dissonant, is a kind of improvisation from one moment to the next, and that it's only from this sense of crisis that one can truly awaken to the truth. So that family and school, in their habitual ways of operating, and their reliance on various kinds of solids, he would call conceptual solids, stood in the way of this recognition. I mean, his attitude actually was quite ambivalent toward the bourgeoisie. You know, he saw the bourgeois complacency as a stumbling block in the way of truth, and at the same time, he remained faithful in many ways to his habits as a bourgeois scholar and relied on the newest advances in technology and also on a certain kind of bourgeois comfort in his own way of living. In the 1930s, he published a volume of letters called German Men and Women, how it's been translated, Deutsche Menschen, which is a kind of commemoration of the great age of the bourgeoisie from the late 18th century through the end of the 19th century. So a further example of his ambivalence toward bourgeois ways of thinking and life.
What about the political path? What about the use of politics to get to the truth, to get to the larger truth? What did he think, for example, of the advisability of young people participating in traditional partisan politics?
The youth movement, at least the branch of it that he was involved in, was essentially nonpartisan. And in a letter from early 1913, he refers to politics as the art of choosing the lesser evil. He basically tried to maintain a distance from partisan politics. And at the same time, he felt that what he was doing was fundamentally political. He felt that politics begins in education and comes to fruition in culture. So he had a mission of politics in the broadest sense, he would say. But he was opposed to politics in the narrow sense.
And he made certain parallels between political action and religious observance. That may surprise some people. What kinds of relationship did he see between those two arenas?
That's an extremely difficult question that hovers over his whole career, and that many people have wrestled with, the relationship between the political and the theological in Benjamin. I quote in my introduction to that volume a letter that he wrote to his friend Gershom Scholem in the 1920s, in which he uses the term observance, and he refers to both political and religious observance. Again, something, an observance beyond all churches that was neither piety nor mysticism, and that had to do with an attentiveness to each moment, actually, and to the decision, he said, implicit in each moment. The language is actually very Kierkegaardian, the idea that each moment is a kind of portal to possible awakening and to a kind of decision, a kind of either-or. I know this sounds very abstract. It's hard to actually be clearer about the ways in which the theological and the political come together, and it's very difficult to point to any concrete evidence of their correlation.
Well, he's certainly not talking about organized religion, right, of traditional dogma.
That's right. He's basically very much opposed to organized religion of any sort, and certainly to any kind of dogmatic thinking, whether it be religious or philosophical. His attitude toward the individual is relevant here. He doesn't think of himself as an individualist, but there's a highly individualizing quality to his sense of awakening and of the mission of youth. He talks about the importance for politics of the cultivation of solitude. The learning community that we were just talking about is a community of individual consciences. And the individual conscience is something cultivated only in solitude. On the other hand, solitude, a meaningful solitude, is possible only within a kind of community of thought. But the community of thought presupposes the cultivation of solitude. So there's a circle there, another of these paradoxes.
Mm-hmm.
It's another example of this dialectical thinking as well, that a true community is a community of individuals, and individuality is something that depends upon a certain sociality. So there's a certain skepticism toward both the social and the individual taken in themselves. They require each other. But that the purely social is something dangerous, and the purely individual cut off from any social responsibility is obviously dangerous as well. So politics constantly comes back in his mind to this dialectical interaction. Balancing is not exactly the right idea, but a kind of moving toward the two extremes simultaneously so that each extreme is taken into account of in the final state of consciousness.
Idealism. So already in discussing or promoting the possibility of a new humanity, we get the sense that ideals drove Benjamin to a large extent. Can you talk more about what Benjamin thought about youthful idealism, the importance of it to what people would grow up to become, and where such idealism perhaps originated?
This is a letter that he wrote to a medical student friend of his, Carla Seligson, in 1913, I believe it is. He says, "This is the most important thing. We must not fasten on any particular idea, not even the idea of youth culture. For then, if we do not turn ourselves into mere workers in a movement, if we keep our gaze free to see the spirit, wherever it may be, we will be the ones to actualize it. Almost everybody forgets that they themselves are the place where spirit actualizes itself. But because they have made themselves inflexible, turned themselves into pillars of a building instead of vessels or bowls that can receive and shelter an ever purer content, they despair of the actualization we feel within ourselves. This soul is something eternally actualizing. Every person, every soul that is born can bring to life the new reality. We feel it in ourselves, and we also want to establish it from out of ourselves." That's the letter, passage from the letter that he wrote. So this idealism was a feeling, first of all. It was not exactly a concept. It was a feeling of readiness. And here again, the theological vocabulary is very important. That passage actually begins with a statement about what it means to be young. He says, "To be young means not so much serving the Spirit as awaiting it." And, of course, the idea of awaiting has a long history of theological thinking, going back to the Old Testament and the New Testament. This notion of readiness, of waiting for the Spirit to announce itself in any particular thing, in the smallest, most inconspicuous thing at any moment. And it's not a question of possessing the truth, but rather of actualizing it. So that awakening here and actualizing has this, again, this dynamic meaning. So this is an idealism that is very much in touch with bodily existence and with the concrete reality of the everyday world. It's not a set of concepts that could be applied to any particular course of action. And it's something, as I was suggesting a minute ago, that is in a way improvised anew at every moment.
So Benjamin's spirit, what he calls the spirit, might be what we call truth in the most general sense?
Yes. I mean, but again, truth is for him not something that can be possessed. And it's not even something that can be known. He distinguishes between truth and knowledge. Knowledge has to do with the possession of information, of facts, the acquisition of skills. This is what the school gives us, and the family too, and that's what he's opposed to, is this materialization and instrumentalization of knowledge and of education, of truth and of education, so that something that we can possess and then sort of rely on and base ourselves on and feel secure about. Whereas the truth for Benjamin is something that we cannot feel secure about. It's sort of like walking on water. There is this secularization of religious concepts here. Nothing to do with piety, but everything to do with a sense of readiness, is what I was calling readiness. And here Hamlet is also important, Hamlet's idea of readiness. He cites Hamlet in a number of his early essays in the youth magazine, De Anfang, the beginning that he's writing in the years before the World War I.
What you're saying must inform Benjamin's opinions of vocational learning, of professional instruction that would prepare a young person for a vocation.
Exactly. His essays in this journal, Der Anfang, are consistently opposed to any idea of education as merely a preparation for professional life, any kind of vocational and professional apparatus in the university. What's at stake in education for him is, you could say, the emancipation of the creative spirit. And thus, there is this desire to unify the disciplines, to bring together the disciplines that have separated themselves in the acquisition of specialized knowledge, to bring them together in their hidden basis, which is the idea of knowledge itself. And in this idea of knowledge, there are a whole set of questions that lie concealed, questions, very basic questions, such as, who am I? Where do I come from? And where am I going? Who are we? So that the vocational and professional apparatus has to be, in a way, dissolved, loosened up. And these fundamental questions that are at the basis of any idea of knowledge have to be released and brought before the creative spirit.
And we'll take a short music break and be back with Howard Island.